time Donald Trump won the White House, the transition didn't go smoothly. This time around, is Trump ready to put together his administration, or is he set to repeat history? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Elon Musk is a billionaire. I'm sure you know that. He owns SpaceX, Tesla, and the social media site X. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm E. Martinez. Now, Musk is expected to take a role in Trump's presidency. What will his growing power in Washington mean for him and the rest of us? Also, how California leaders hope to Trump-proof their state. And who needs buzz? Rapper Tyler, the Creator, has the number one album in the U.S. despite hardly any time between when he announced it to when it was released. It's Friday, November 8th. Yankee slugger Giancarlo Stanton is 35 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President-elect Donald Trump has tapped his campaign manager, Susie Wiles, to be his next White House chief of staff. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Wiles will be the first woman to serve in the role.
Trump touted Susie Wiles as helping him make history. In a statement, he said, quote, "Susie's a tough, smart, innovative, and is universally admired and respected." Trump went on to say the role was well-deserved and that she would make the country proud. Wiles has worked for Trump's political operation off and on since 2016. She's widely credited with leading Trump's most disciplined campaign operation. Wiles did so quietly, remaining largely in the background and avoiding media and public appearances. She declined to speak on election night, for example, when Trump called her to the stage during his victory speech in West Palm Beach. Trump called her the Ice Maiden. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, West Palm Beach.
Exit polls show more Latino voters backed Kamala Harris than those who chose Donald Trump. But data also show that Democrats have been winning fewer Latino votes in the past several presidential elections. Political consultant Mike Madrid says that's because Latino voters are leading an emerging group of working class voters. He says many are leaving the Democratic Party as they become more pocketbook voters rather than aligning with racial or ethnic identity issues.
There's a lot of evidence to suggest that Latinos are becoming a more economic populist voter. There's very little evidence suggesting they're becoming more conservative. And that's an important distinction, because when Donald Trump talks about no taxes on tips, you know, restrictionist in trade, closing the border, he's really speaking to the angst of a lot of these blue-collar workers.
He spoke to NPR's All Things Considered. Some congressional races remain too close to call, and that means it's still not yet clear which party will control the House of Representatives. Republicans have flipped control of the Senate and will hold at least 53 seats. The Senate races in Arizona and Nevada have not yet been called. The Prime Minister of the Netherlands says he is horrified by violent clashes between pro-Palestinian protesters and Israeli soccer supporters last night in Amsterdam. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports that Dutch police say this led to the arrest of 62 people.
Amsterdam police say they've launched an investigation into multiple violent incidents involving fans of an Israeli soccer team who clashed with pro-Palestinian protesters following a match between a Tel Aviv club and a local Amsterdam team. Police say five people have been hospitalized and that they are aware of reports involving a hostage situation and possible missing persons, but have not been able to confirm them. Dutch Prime Minister Dick Schoof called the attacks on Israeli fans anti-Semitic and completely unacceptable. He promised Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the perpetrators would be identified and prosecuted.
This is NPR. There are blizzard warnings up for northeast New Mexico. Other parts of the state are under winter storm warnings. Some areas could get up to 8 inches of snow. Forecasters say travel could be difficult or even impossible. New Mexico's governor has declared a state of emergency to help residents deal with the wintry storm. California fire officials say a wildfire in Ventura County has destroyed 132 structures in about 2 days. Most of them are homes. It's burned more than 32 square miles, and it's only 5% contained. From member station KLCU, Lance Orozco reports the fire is being pushed by the phenomenon known as the Santa Ana winds.
Firefighters are getting a break from the 80-mile-an-hour gust that quickly propelled the wildfire out of control Wednesday. Here's Ventura County Fire Chief Dustin Gardner.
It was a significant 36-hour firefight. Many firefighters, they fought fire for 36 straight hours.
While the threat may be subsiding, it could be days before the fire is contained. Jim Buchanan was an evacuee whose home was undamaged, but his neighborhood was hard hit.
Massive destruction, to say the least. I always thought we were pretty safe.
Governor Gavin Newsom toured the fire zone and proclaimed a state of emergency to set the stage for state and federal aid. For NPR News, I'm Lance Orozco in Thousand Oaks, California.
The National Hurricane Center says that Hurricane Rafael is a powerful Category 3 storm swirling in the Gulf of Mexico. It's moving toward the west. Weather forecasters say the storm will drift in the Gulf for a few days and slowly lose strength. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Schwab, with Schwab investing themes like artificial intelligence, renewable energy, or pet passion. Over 40 themes to invest in. Learn more at schwab.com. And the Doris Duke Foundation.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
This Minnesotan set out to study starch granules, but he ended up discovering a cereal shot from guns.
As you know, Quaker Puffed Wheat and Quaker Puffed Rice are shot from guns.
Alexander Anderson had accidentally come upon the process of puffing wheat and rice. In 1904, he had the vision to see its practical implications. So Anderson pitched a puffed breakfast cereal to Quaker Oats, who wasn't so interested. Undeterred, the Minnesota botanist threw on his showman's cap and made a beeline for the St. Louis World's Fair. In the agricultural building, Anderson barked audiences to gather. He took brass tubes, stuffed them with wheat and rice, and turned them over flames. With a flourish worthy of P.T. Barnum, he uncapped the tubes. Out sprang a shower of white puffs, so tasty. Audiences snapped them up by the nickel bag. Within 3 years, Quaker was touting a new line of cereals.
Remember,
with an explosive
Quaker
tagline.
Quaker puffed rice are shot from guns.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Faudel in Washington, D.C. Coming up, we ask a former Democratic congressman from Michigan how Vice President Harris lost his state.
We begin, though, with the president-elect. Days after Donald Trump declared victory, the negotiations to work out a handoff of the government are underway. Yesterday at the White House, President Biden said he's been in touch with the president-elect.
And I assured him that I'd direct my entire administration work with his team to ensure a peaceful and orderly transition. That's what the American people deserve.
There are already questions, though, about whether Trump's second transition is on track. Here's NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith.
A week before Trump won, the co-chair of his transition, Howard Lutnick, projected confidence in an interview with CNN.
We are ready for the transition for Trump Vance. We are so ready.
He's heading up the search for people to fill positions in the new Trump administration.
We've got so many candidates. We are so set up. I feel great. And it is completely different than it was like in 2016.
In 2016, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie spent months building a transition plan for Trump, working cooperatively with the outgoing Obama administration. And then, as he told the Transition Lab podcast, 2 days after the election, Christie was fired by Trump advisor Steve Bannon.
And I said, "Are you kidding me?" And he said, no, Vice President Pence is now going to be the chair of the transition, and you're out."
Not only was Christie out, but he said, so were all the plans.
They had won a race that most people didn't think they could win. And now they thought, man, now we're going to run a transition in an unconventional way and watch everybody, you know, react to that.
With cameras trained on the elevators in the lobby of Trump Tower in New York, the president-elect put on a show.
We've got some great people coming in today. You'll see them.
In the end, Trump picked a whole lot of people who just weren't a good fit. Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, former General James Mattis as Defense Secretary, The list of hiring misses in 2016 is a long one. And because Trump's team threw out months of planning, they were left with a lot of Obama holdovers in high-ranking acting positions when Trump took office. On the podcast, Christie said the Trump administration never fully recovered from its rough start.
So you have people there who are hostile to the president personally and hostile to his agenda that he had just been elected on, and then he would wonder why he couldn't get things done.
Clay Johnson led George W. Bush's transition in the year 2000. He says transitions are a huge management challenge.
It was just so hard and unbelievable. You know, people were crying and were losing sleep and so forth and so on, but a lot has to happen. An incredible amount has to happen in a very short period of time.
Johnson says there are thousands of jobs to fill and untold numbers of people working their connections to get in. But he tried to tune out the noise.
The most important thing to pick the right people is to figure out what is the picture of success that you aspire to realize on behalf of the country.
Trump announced late yesterday that he picked his campaign manager, Susie Wiles, to be his White House chief of staff. A campaign advisor says the jockeying for jobs in the administration has already gotten intense. Loyalty to Trump and a desire to disrupt Washington are top qualifications this time. But the Trump transition is already disrupting Washington by failing to sign two formal documents that would give them access to everything from government email addresses to detailed information about agency operations.
It has not happened, and they are late.
Max Steyer heads the Partnership for Public Service, which has assisted past transitions. He says this delay sends a very bad signal and could mean Trump is about to repeat history.
The Trump team did not understand the process or the importance of understanding that process and did not respect that process and paid a real price. And I fear that we might see something similar again.
A Trump campaign spokesman tells NPR the transition team is still having conversations about the documents and, quote, we will update you once a decision is made. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
After losing the White House and Senate in Tuesday's election, along with the popular vote, the Democratic Party will now start to look at what went wrong. Why did the majority of Americans choose to go back to Donald Trump, a man who ran a campaign filled with dark messaging and whose longest-running former chief of staff, John Kelly, warned would rule like a dictator? Our next guest is a former Democratic member of the House. Andy Levin represented Michigan's 9th District until last year. He's a longtime Democrat and labor activist and now is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He joins us this morning from Bloomfield Township, Michigan. Good morning.
Good morning, Layla.
Thanks for being on the program. You're in this key swing state that Vice President Harris lost. When you look at the results, why do you think the messaging from Harris and the Democratic Party just didn't resonate with a majority of voters, especially among the working class?
Well, you know, I think the story in Michigan is mostly the story across the country. I do want to say that Kamala Harris was thrust into this situation so late, and she did an amazing job kind of personally in the debate and on. But I think there were three big things. The first was a failure to separate herself from a really historically unpopular president. I loved serving with President Biden in the last Congress, but he was super unpopular. And she didn't make clear to the public how she would be different. And on this first point, Layla, you do have to have a Michigan-specific footnote about Gaza, about Lebanon.
And we spoke about that back in February, where you said at the time Biden was the candidate, and you said, I don't see how you win the presidency without winning Michigan, and I don't think Biden can win Michigan unless he changes course. Is that what happened in Michigan?
That is partly what happened in Michigan. The idea of Vice President Harris losing Dearborn outright and doing so poorly in Hamtramck and not doing as well among students and so forth. But, you know, I think the bigger picture, look, she lost across the country, of course, and even did less well in places like New York and Virginia and other places. So she didn't separate herself. The second big reason, Layla, is inflation. I mean, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, and now Kamala Harris trying to run for re-election or in Harris's campaign to succeed her president, after a period of very difficult inflation. And she needed a really strong message on the economy. Of course, this is sweeping the whole world, right, in the post-COVID era. And the third big reason was focusing on Trump rather than on her agenda. You know, everybody knows who Donald Trump is and what a horrible human being he is and how, you know, he's a convicted criminal and so forth. But she, you know, she had a little time. And I just think this gets to the broader problem of the Democratic Party. We have got to straight up be the party of the working class about unions, wages, pensions, universal health care. We've got to stop messing around with a lot of different messages. Look at what happened with Latinos. People can say that, you know,
Latino men specifically turning out exactly. In large numbers, not a majority, but in large numbers for Trump in ways that we haven't
seen.
So
let's talk about the whole working class. Mm-hmm. It's not just white men in hard hats, right? It's women and men. It's African-Americans, Latinos, whites, others. And we have to have a universal message to all working class people that we are the party of uplift for workers.
So you agree with Senator Bernie Sanders, who issued a pretty scathing statement after the results, saying that a Democratic Party which has abandoned working class people would find that the working class has abandoned them. That's what he said. He said American people are angry and want change. Do you agree with that assessment?
Basically, I do. I mean, I do. You know, working people look and say, well, which is the party that's going to be tough on corporations and actually deal with this huge crisis of wealth and income inequality? I mean, to me, Layla, here's the thing. A working person, you know, way up into the middle class is anxious about their economic prospects, about their kids. And Democrats have to be the party that they clearly understand, like, yeah, I'm going to make more money if Democrats are in charge. I'm going to have a union. I'm going to have a you know, living wage as a minimum wage. We're going to have health care, universal health care, if Democrats are in charge. I'm going to have child care that I can afford. You know, we came close to passing child care that would cost no more than 7% of a family's income. We have to actually center like a laser on economic programs, economic justice. And if we marry it with human rights around the world, I think it's a winning formula.
What do you say to members within your party who blame the left within the party? People like Senator Sanders and others who have had focus on Gaza and other things for the problem itself. I mean, Harris ran ultimately a more centrist campaign and bringing even people to the right of her into the tent.
Right. How did that work out? Not very well. I don't hear a lot of people. I'm sure there will be, you know, bickering. And I just think this is a time to really look forward.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, I came of age when Ronald Reagan became president. And the of all the canvassing I did this year, the one visit that really resonated to me was a 69-year-old guy who said he hadn't worked since he was 58. He was sort of retired unwillingly. He was a welder. He said, the best years were 1975 to 1980. I could quit one job and go give myself a raise by going to another. Mm. And I said, yeah, what happened in 1980? And that was the election of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
And so we really have to get back to separating ourselves from the Republicans and focusing on, not in a fake way like Trump, but in a real way that we are the party of workers who just want to make a decent living and not be anxious from one paycheck to another.
And just really quickly, is your party ready to do that?
A lot of us are. And I think we would be do really well if we could focus on this from the campuses mm-hmm. to the working class cities and suburbs.
Former Democratic Congressman Andy Levin, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Layla.
This is NPR News.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. For thousands of years, wild blueberries have grown in Nova Scotia. Today, farmers manage many of these naturally occurring fields and harvest the fruit. But as the climate changes, the region's wild blueberry industry faces a range of problems. David Percival of Dalhousie University says blueberry fields usually bloom during a few weeks in spring. But this year, warmer temperatures caused many fields to bloom all at once. So pollinators like bees did not have much time to visit and fertilize all the flowers, a necessary step to produce berries.
Because the bloom was so compressed in a short period of time, we just couldn't get the number of visits and the adequate movement of pollen to give us a good crop.
Percival says as the climate warms, growers are also struggling to control more weeds in their fields. So he's working to help them adapt. For example, by conducting drone surveys that show which areas of a field should be targeted for weed control. He says he's motivated by the long history of some of these wild blueberry fields.
You almost feel as though there's this inherent responsibility, you know, to keep the plant healthy, keep it sustainable, and really pass it along to the next generation.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Drexel University, whose model of experiential education allows students to choose their own path and explore the world, enabling them to discover their perfect career. More at drexel.edu. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the estate of Jane Gross, whose bequest supports NPR's commitment to creating a more informed public by distributing programming that meets the highest standards of public service and journalism. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Amy Martinez. It was almost 4 years ago that a mob of Donald Trump's supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol.
Federal authorities have charged more than 1,000 people in connection with the January 6th attack. And now Trump is headed back to the White House after promising to pardon the people charged in connection with that attack.
NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has covered the January 6th investigation. So, Ryan, let's start with Trump and potential pardons. What has he said about clemency for Capitol rioters?
Well, first off, for years, Trump has tried to rewrite the history of January 6th. He talks about it as a peaceful day instead of what it actually was, which is a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol by his supporters, an attack that injured more than 140 police officers who were defending the building that day. It was an attack that the FBI director, a Trump appointee, has called domestic terrorism. Trump, though, has called the people who are facing federal charges for January 6th. He's called them hostages. He's called them political prisoners. And over the past few years, including very much so during the 2024 campaign, Trump has promised pardons for January 6th rioters if he were to win back the presidency. He said that he would absolutely pardon them. And now he's headed back to the White House.
That federal investigation into the January 6th riots, where does that stand?
Well, look, this is a massive investigation, one of the largest in the history of the Justice Department. It started on the day of the riot, and it is still going on as of today. So far, more than 1,500 people have been charged. Almost 1,000 have pleaded guilty. Many of those are for misdemeanors, but a lot of them are also for violent offenses, things like assaulting police with a deadly weapon. Around 200 people have been convicted at trial. That includes members of two far-right extremist groups, the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. 10 members of those two groups have been convicted at trial of seditious conspiracy, in other words, of opposing the authority of the U.S. government by force.
I know the Justice Department is looking to wind down the special counsel's cases against Donald Trump now that he's now going to be president. Does that affect the DOJ's work against the Capitol rioters?
So the decision to unwind Special Counsel Jack Smith's cases against Trump, that stems from a Justice Department policy that says that a sitting president can't face indictment or trial. That policy does not apply to anyone else, full stop. That said, I did ask the Justice Department whether the potential for mass pardons of January 6th defendants has changed its approach to these cases. The department declined to comment on that, but I will say that prosecutors have been bringing new January 6th cases this week, so it does appear to be business as usual.
So the defendants, then, are they angling for pardons? I got to imagine that probably that's true.
They definitely are. They're certainly aware of Trump's promises for pardons, and they are angling for them. That goes for nonviolent offenders. It also goes, though, for folks convicted of attacking police and other serious charges. Stuart Rhodes is an example of this. He is the founder of the Oath Keepers group that I mentioned earlier. Rhodes was convicted by a jury in D.C. of seditious conspiracy and other crimes in connection with January 6th. The judge sentenced him to 18 years in prison, called him an ongoing threat to the country and its democracy. Rhodes' trial is one that Trump kept a close eye on, I'm told. Now, Rhodes' attorney, Lee Bright, tells our colleague, Kerry Johnson, that he's going to personally urge Trump to do the right and honorable thing and pardon Rhodes. I have asked the Trump campaign whether Trump would pardon rioters convicted of violent crimes or just nonviolent ones. The campaign did not respond.
NPR's Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thanks.
Thank you.
Time now for StoryCorps. Alex Ortiz helps fellow veterans in Puerto Rico adjust to civilian life. In the army, he deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. His wife, Lixani, had never been close to a veteran before they met and wasn't always prepared for their life together.
What do you remember most about when we met?
I think it would be your eyes, because I remember staring at you and you wondering why I was looking at you so much. I kept telling you that I needed to remember your face. And you not only wanted to get to know me, but my son, Brian. So that's what set you apart and put you in the front of the line.
You know, when I left the military, I felt like I was lost and I needed to reset my life and figure out how can I feel useful again. And when I first met you, it was almost like I could travel to the future and see that everything was going to be okay. What do you want people to know about being a spouse of a veteran?
So our community has these really big mango trees. And I remember you were driving the car and a mango fell on our car.
When that mango hit that glass, it was so loud.
And you extended your right arm right into my chest.
I know. I was trying to keep you safe.
You stopped the car, stopped it so fast. And I screamed at you, like, what are you doing? Go. And you're like, I think a mango just fell on our car. But it took me back to when there was bombs happening around us.
It's hard to explain until you lived it. But I still reacted how I was trained to. Those quick reactions make me feel safe. Like I'm still competent enough to protect my family.
I think my family does too. When Hurricane Maria happened in 2017, my sister kept saying, oh, she should be okay. Alex is a military guy. He's like MacGyver. It's something that's been embedded into your DNA. Military life is for you because you talk about it all the time. I mean, you'll go down a rabbit hole and never stop. Recently, we had issues because you're so devoted to helping veterans that it's affected our relationship.
I think that's the perfect example because it creates that tunnel vision, but I only have limited time. You know, you guys are the foundation on what I'm building my life upon. I just hope that I can always not only be there for you, but for the kids too.
That was Sergeant Alex Ortiz with his wife, Lixani. Ortiz is completing law school to further his support for veterans, and their conversation is archived in the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance, dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. And from Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness.
This is NPR News.
Director Malcolm Washington first read August Wilson's play, The Piano Lesson, during a pivotal time in his life.
It was at a time when I was trying to understand who I was in the context of all that came before me.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Malcolm Washington on bringing The Piano Lesson to the big screen with his whole family on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Oh.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock this afternoon on KAXC with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 529. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Friday Morning Show. In a few minutes, our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer. Mostly sunny today, highs 49 to 55, winds from the northwest around 5 miles per hour. For tonight, mostly clear, lows near 32, and tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs near 50, slight chance of rain, winds from the south 5 to 15, and looking ahead to Sunday, chance of rain in the morning, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 40s. You can join us this week on Stay Human, an hour of story and song. Fred Friedman and Sonia Merrill attend citizenship swearing-in ceremonies. Robert Jevney breaks down the Gettysburg Address and Marsh Muirhead on love of country plus American anthems too. Stay Human airs every Saturday at 9 a.m., Sunday at 5 p.m. Minnesota's firearm deer season opens tomorrow. The DNR reminds hunters that they are required to register every deer within 48 hours of harvest. Certain permit areas also require chronic wasting disease testing. Go to the DNR's website for more details, and don't forget to wear blaze orange whenever you are in the woods during hunting season, whether you are a hunter or not. The Bemidji Chorale and Festival Orchestra presents a concert this Sunday at 3 p.m. at Thompson Recital Hall on the BSU campus. There will also be a pie auction and reception. The National Alliance on Mental Illness presents a free Hope for Recovery workshop Wednesday, November 13th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Mesabi Unitarian Church in Virginia. It is designed for loved ones of those living with mental illness and will include discussion and interactive exercises, plus support and connection among peers. Thank you for tuning in to KAXE this morning. It is time for our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer.
On today's date, November 8th, 1999, I notice a patch of pussy willows that are little white buds, little white flowers, already out, ready for spring. Now, I will continue watching these flowers all winter, and nothing will happen. They will continue to remain in that little white stage, but they'll stay in that little white stage all winter. So they, for some reason, just shed their sheath and show that little fuzzy white bud way early in November. Now, this is not typical of pussy willows in general. Typically, the pussy willows will emerge in late February or early March, and then we will follow their progression to full flower later on in mid-April. But every year, the careful observer will spot perhaps one or two bushes with some little white furry flowers.
Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Solidigm, focused on making solid-state storage optimized for performance and efficiency, Solidigm believes a new era in AI requires a new approach to data storage. Storage for AI.com.
and from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President-elect Trump may not be the richest man in his administration. Trump talked of a post for Elon Musk of Tesla and SpaceX. Musk was one of Trump's main campaign contributors and also used X, the social media site, to promote him. Now Musk is close to the future leader of a government with which he does a lot of business. Ronan Farrow wrote in The New Yorker of Musk's Defense Department and NASA contracts worth billions of dollars.
Elon Musk has become this indispensable figure across the U.S. government. And there are certain services he can provide, like his Starlink satellite services, like certain space shuttle abilities to bring astronauts into space. There aren't a lot of valid competitors when the government is looking at companies to bid. And by the way, this manifests everywhere from the war in Ukraine, where he was providing, through his Starlink services, essential internet access for the Ukrainians, and that became strategically important.
And turned out to have opinions about the war.
Yeah, well, exactly so. You know, he was providing internet services and then curtailing it in certain ways. And there were these questions of, is that because he's loyal to Putin? So this is a person who just has immense sway, really to a kind of unprecedented extent, according to historians I talked to who kind of track the role of business titans in American politics over the years.
I want to emphasize why you think that is, because the United States government is paying the bills. You could imagine with a contractor that that gives the government influence over the contractor. But you're telling me that because his services are so scarce, he is the one with the power in that relationship.
That's right. That was the surprising thing that I found when I dug into these government relationships and talked to some of the government officials who are on the other end of those conversations, that they often felt very cowed and very subject to his whims.
What did he do to help elect Donald Trump?
He spent a really tremendous amount of money through his PAC to try to get Donald Trump elected. He's one of the founders of the America PAC, which has spent over $175 million. 130 plus of that really came out of Musk's pocket. He controversially awarded a $1 million reward to someone who would register to vote. So he's really been going all out to get this man elected. And to wit, Elon Musk spent election night at Mar-a-Lago with Trump.
So what can a president do for you when you're already the world's richest man and it seems you have a dominant position over the U.S. government in your chosen fields anyway?
Well, Trump said he would appoint Musk to a government efficiency coalition. And the way he described that was that Elon Musk would be auditing the entire federal government. And Musk has now talked about that evolving into something called the Department of Government Efficiency. And the Trump team has hedged a little on what that's going to look like. Is it going to actually happen? How robust is that role going to be? But I think that's why it's important that we're talking about it now, because it truly would be unprecedented and troubling to have someone who has this many national security sensitive relationships with the government in a role of potentially explicit oversight over the budgets of those same government agencies.
I'm still trying to figure out what would be in it for Musk. That sounds like a lot of work to cut trillions of dollars of federal government spending, which other people have tried to do and failed. Like, what does he get?
Well, this is a longer conversation, and there's certainly an ideological component. However, it's important to note that this is not only a person who has active business relationships with the government that could stand to benefit from him being in the government if he doesn't recuse himself in proper ways. He's also a person who's under active investigation by the government. The Department of Justice and the National Highway Transportation Safety Agency both have investigations into his auto company, Tesla. They're looking into deaths associated with crashes in Tesla vehicles that had that technology in them. And so we see in that a mirror image of Donald Trump, who is also an individual who's under a lot of investigation and for whom getting into government is a potential lifeline and a way out of those sources of scrutiny.
I'm just thinking through. People used to doubt if Trump was a billionaire, but I suppose with his social media stock, you can say that he's a billionaire for sure now. You've got Elon Musk, who's a many, many billionaire. You've got John Paulson, a billionaire, has been talked about for a cabinet position. You have other people out there who have supported his side of the argument, people like Bill Ackman. Are we heading for a government of billionaires here?
Yeah, I mean, this is an observation that I got from a lot of those historians I talked to, because I was so interested by this imbalance of power that I saw in Musk's relationship with the government. A lot of those experts who have looked at the historical arc of this talked about us entering into an era of oligarchy in the United States.
Ronan Farrow, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
NPR reached out to the Trump team for comment on any conflict of interest protocols for Elon Musk's potential government role. We don't yet have a response.
The last time Donald Trump was president, the attorney general here in California filed more than 120 lawsuits against the Trump administration on policies ranging from climate to immigration. Now, California is gearing up to challenge him again. Governor Gavin Newsom has called for lawmakers to convene a special session to fund new lawsuits. CAP Radio's Megan Myskowski reports from Sacramento.
In his press release announcing the call, Governor Gavin Newsom said the freedoms Californians hold dear are, quote, under attack, unquote. His office said they're preparing to go to court over expected policies on civil and reproductive rights, climate action, and immigration.
In these situations, speed matters, being prepared matters.
Democratic Assemblymember Jesse Gabriel was a constitutional attorney and assisted with two lawsuits against Trump's first administration. He's supportive of Newsom calling for lawmakers to work on this ahead of the regular legislative session in January.
We don't know for sure what's going to happen. I think it's important to recognize that. But reading Project 2025, listening to some of the things that the president-elect has talked about on the campaign trail, understanding his record from his first term, we know that we might be engaged in some very significant and very serious litigation.
California's legislature has a Democratic supermajority, but it isn't clear at this point what, if anything, will be passed in the special session. Meanwhile, many Republican legislators say the move is a stunt by the governor, including Senator Brian Dahle.
He's the happiest guy around that Kamala lost because this gives him an opportunity to run for president in 4 years.
Dahle says he wants the money Newsom is proposing for litigation to be directed towards other things.
We don't have these kind of resources to be thrown around. We have crime, we have cost of living we need to deal with in California.
The special session will start on December 2nd. For NPR News, I'm Megan Myskowski in Sacramento.
As we transition to a new president, get the news and analysis you know and trust right in your inbox. The stories you need to start your day, handpicked for you every weekday, plus the best of NPR every Sunday. Sign up at npr.org/upfirstnewsletter. This is NPR News.
AXE, we keep it local.
What kind of instruments should we expect at this percussion ensemble?
Starting from the stage right, we would have like timpani. There's a drum set involved in there.
I just miss people. Grandparents and the way things were. And you feel a lot of things this time of year, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in my family.
What was that like? Tell me about it.
It's very fun. I tried to make the lollipops as big as I can make them.
Like as big as your head or how big?
I'm Heidi Holton. We need your support to keep it local. Text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234. And thanks.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from National Geographic Documentary Films, presenting Endurance. Endurance follows a team of modern-day explorers who face the Herculean task of finding Sir Ernest Shackleton's famous sunken ship, now streaming on Hulu and Disney+. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Martinez. Investigations are now underway around the country into racist text messages sent to black people, including college and high school students, over the past couple of days. It's not clear who or what is behind the texts, which reference slavery. NPR's Debbie Elliott has been looking into this. Debbie, so what's showing up on people's phones?
Well, these were very offensive and disturbing, and I guess we should be clear with our listeners about that in case they might want to tune out for a bit rather than hear about it. The messages all share a similar theme, telling recipients that they've been selected for some sort of indentured servitude, to pick cotton at the nearest plantation, for instance, or to be a, quote, house slave, and then instructions about being picked up in a van or maybe picked up by and, quote, executive slave. They've been targeted primarily at young black people, from what we're hearing, many of them on high school, even middle school campuses, and then college students.
Wow, pretty vile all the way around. When were these messages sent?
You know, they started going out Wednesday and then more on Thursday. They're coming from phone numbers that appear to be local to the recipient's area code, but they don't identify who's behind it, and they actually name the recipients in some cases. I tried to call a few of those numbers, but each time I got a recording that the number I was trying to reach was no longer in service. So really, there are more questions than answers at this point.
So what's been the reaction to this? I can imagine people are not happy.
Well, understandably, you know, I think students in particular are frightened, like, who got my number and why are they sending me this threatening text? And of course, parents are irate. The 17-year-old high school son of St. Louis's mayor, Tashara Jones, got one of these texts Wednesday night while the two of them were watching television. His classmates also got some of these, and she is just furious about it.
These are some sick, twisted individuals to target children like this, and I hope that they are found and prosecuted.
Her father, the student's grandfather, Vervis Jones, who lived through Jim Crow, says this is no joking matter to harken back to something as horrible as slavery. It's not lost on him the timing of these texts coming a day after a contentious and dark election.
What it says about this country is that there are a lot of people who would like to take us back to some form of slavery or some form of being subservient to white supremacists. That's what it says to me.
So, Debbie, I mean, the texts are already sent, but can anything be done about them now?
Well, it's certainly got campuses on alert, some even offering counseling for students, and authorities at every level are launching investigations all around the country. Civil rights groups have been encouraging people to report the threatening texts to police and the FBI. I spoke with Margaret Huang, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks hate groups.
The key is we need to know how many people have received this and what the scale and scope
of this effort is. And to do that, we need people to take it seriously and let us know.
She says they're working to track down the origin of the text and are sharing what they find with federal officials. It's not clear at all whether these messages are originating from the U.S. or maybe from abroad. The FBI says it's aware of the offensive and racist text messages and is in contact with the Justice Department and other federal officials on the matter. And then a number of state attorneys general say they, too, have opened investigations.
All right, that's NPR's Debbie Elliott. Debbie, thanks.
You're welcome.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Emmy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Thanks so much for listening to KAXE KBXE. My name is Heather Johnson, and I'm the membership coordinator here. If you're enjoying our music, news, phonology updates, and conversations, consider supporting the station by becoming a KAXE KBXE member today. Do you have questions about membership? We offer many options for making your contribution. I would love to chat with you. Give me a call at 218-326-1234.
Many voters don't feel good about the economy, but one of the most powerful economic policymakers in the country thinks it's going okay and getting better.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden, a password manager for business designed to help turn end-of-year IT budgets into long-term enterprise security success. Learn more at bitwarden.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. The Federal Reserve cut its short-term interest rate by a quarter of a percentage point yesterday. At his briefing, Fed Chair Jerome Powell stayed away from politics despite the freshness of the news of Donald Trump's decisive victory. But many of Trump's proposals could affect the scale and timing of changes to the central bank's interest rate policy. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer was at the briefing.
Fed Chair Jerome Powell says he feels good about the current state of the economy.
The labor market has cooled from its formerly overheated state and remains solid. Inflation has eased substantially from a peak of 7% to 2.1% as of September.
This latest interest rate cut is meant to keep things on track, but some economists say President-elect Trump's plans for tariffs, tax cuts, and an immigration crackdown could reignite inflation or even cause stagflation, where economic growth stalls but inflation and unemployment rise. I asked Powell what he would do if stagflation became a problem.
The whole plan is not to have stagflation, so we don't have to deal with it. So that is actually our plan.
The Fed's main inflation-fighting tool is interest rates. When prices spike, the central bank tries to cool the economy by raising rates so it's more expensive to borrow and spend. And yesterday, Powell wouldn't rule out a rate hike next year, although he added that's certainly not the plan at this point.
We're not in a world where we can afford to rule things out a full year in advance. There's just too much uncertainty in what we do.
With all that uncertainty, Powell says what the Fed does next depends on the data on things like unemployment and inflation. Powell says decisions on interest rates will be made meeting by meeting, and the Fed isn't on a preset course. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The U.S. bond market is down this morning, pushing the 10-year interest rate up to 4.3%, reversing course. The average 30-year fixed-rate mortgage fell yesterday to below 7%, using Mortgage News Daily's calculation. A view now on how European investors are moving money on this tumultuous week in politics and monetary policy. The key stock index in Germany, the DAX, is down about 1.7% since Donald Trump's victory and down about 0.9% this morning so far. Joining us from Frankfurt with profits and trade policy in mind is Joachim Stanzel, Chief Market Analyst for Germany and Austria at CMC Markets. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, some Republican allies here of Donald Trump have tried to tamp down concern about the president-elect's tariffs promises, suggesting perhaps it's a bargaining position coming from a deal maker. How is it seen in Europe? Are European investors taking the prospect of much higher tariffs seriously?
There is really a lot of uncertainty. We have seen in the first reaction on the first day when the election results came out that car maker stocks were really decisively down. Then there were a lot of renewable energy companies, stocks really going down. But they have bounced back a bit at least. So there is some speculation that the German market and also European stocks could be like a catch-up play. We see that there is a clear negative decoupling. The DAX is off of its all-time highs. It hasn't made new all-time highs in the past days, while we have all seen that the Dow Jones and S&P 500 had made new all-time highs. So there is clear like respect and doubt that it will be positive in the end for Europe.
Donald Trump's victory this week has also added strength to the dollar, this despite our central bank, the Fed, lowering interest rates yesterday afternoon. That has to be a key calculation when investors are thinking about European profits.
It's really, really interesting how much money has been moved around in the hours after the election results were out. So I think those moves are not something that is going to go away like in the next hours or so. But I rather think that this has been and has been really planned like weeks ahead and weeks before. And those and one of the reactions is that the Fed expectations for their interest rate or for the Fed funds rate in the end, that it will be higher in the end under a Trump administration, as has been like expected and priced in before. Because there are some expectations that tariffs and also tax cuts by Trump are going to be inflationary.
Speaking from Frankfurt, Joachim Stanzel with CMC Markets. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
London's 100 share index is down 0.9%. Now Paris is down 0.8%. The German DAX index, checking again, is down 0.8%. Some of that is the political disarray in Berlin with pressure on Germany's chancellor to call an election soon. Here, S&P futures are down 0.1%. Dow futures are close to unchanged.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
President-elect Trump has made his first major appointment, choosing Susie Wiles as White House Chief of Staff. Wiles helped run the campaign and will be the first woman to hold that position. There are a host of other appointments we're waiting for from the president-elect in the coming weeks and months, which would give us a better sense of how the new president plans to meet promises to change oversight of, for instance, financial markets. Marketplace's Nova Safo is here with more.
Well, under the Biden administration, regulatory agencies such as the Federal Trade Commission, headed by Lina Khan, and the Securities and Exchange Commission, headed by Gary Gensler, have been thorns on the sides of Wall Street and Silicon Valley. They've tightened oversight over cryptocurrency firms, big tech and artificial intelligence, as well as social media companies and financial firms. Now, often chairs of regulatory agencies resign to make way for an incoming administration. But on the campaign trail, President-elect Trump promised to fire Gensler, and he's indicated a desire for more cryptocurrency mining in the U.S. and government actions that would support crypto prices. Under Biden, the FTC's actions have included an attempt to ban non-compete agreements, an effort that is currently stuck in courts, David, and could be abandoned under Trump.
All right. Marketplace's Nova Safo there. Thank you very much. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Good morning. It's a minute before 6 o'clock. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Find playlists, podcasts, and much more at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. There's more ahead for Morning Edition and the Friday Morning Show with Heidi Holton and John Bauer. We'll have our talkback segment at about 6:45. It's always great to hear from our listeners. You can text your thoughts about any of our programming, 218-326-1234. Sunny today with highs 49 to 55, winds from the northwest around 5 miles per hour. Overnight lows near 32, and for tomorrow mostly cloudy, highs near 50 with a slight chance of rain, winds from the south 5 to 15. Looking ahead to Sunday, chance of rain before noon and highs in the upper 40s. We continue with Morning Edition.
Good morning. Donald Trump...